Hello, and welcome to Advisory Explained. I'm your host, Kwesi Kretzinger. Join me in this series, this podcast where we discuss the complex world of advisory. We dive deep into very specific topics in the world of mergers and acquisitions, due diligence, tax, fiduciary services, and so much more, where we take complex topics and we break them down into smaller, bite-sized, palatable portions for you to understand and to understand where we can assist you. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Advisory Explained. Today, I've got Bobby Wessels from AJM Tax again here with me. Welcome, Bobby.
Thank you, Kwesi.
Today, we are going to tackle two powerhouse topics, two of the big tools in SARS's toolkit to tackle interesting transactions. These two are called General Anti-Avoidance Rules. That's the first one, also known as GAR. And the second one we're going to touch on is the simulation doctrine. How a lot of people don't necessarily understand these. It's a complex point, and it sometimes can be quite vague. So today we've got Bobby here to take us through it, to take us through some of the key points, and the most importantly, how to approach it, how to make sure you're not caught up in them. And high level, like we've always said, is always do transactions for commercial reasons, and then we just do the most tax-efficient way. We don't do transactions specifically for tax.
Yeah, of course, not easy topics. Very much debated around their meanings and what they mean in the tax field, academic circles. But in a broad strokes, if we look at the GAR, the first one that you referenced, it really essentially requires four elements.
Mm.
It requires that there's an arrangement. That typically is almost always the case.
Mm-hmm.
The sole main purpose of which, the second requirement, sole main purpose, must be that it was for a tax benefit. The third requirement, there must have been a tax benefit. And then the fourth requirement is that it must have taken place in an abnormal manner.
Mm.
Now, abnormality is one that we can leave for a little bit later. It's particularly tricky, and we don't have much from a sort of South African jurisprudence on the topic. There's been bits and pieces said about it in other laws, Canadian law and some in UK law about what these topics mean. But from a South African perspective, we don't have much on it. The crux of the matter is, if you do a transaction for commercial reasons, there is nothing stopping you from arranging that transaction in the most tax beneficial way. So if you intend to achieve a certain commercial outcome, you are allowed to structure your commercial outcome in the most tax beneficial way. I think that's the sort of the main takeaway about the goal. It means that there's nothing wrong with sometimes doing transactions that involve a tax benefit. It's just, what is the driver of that transaction? And people oftentimes mistake that. They think that, you know, if you do a transaction and there's this tax benefit, then there's something inherently illicit about it. That's just simply not the case. Mm. And there's enough, you know, said about it in all the judgments that have been handed down on the GAR, although there isn't that many of them, to say that, look, you know, taxpayers can arrange their affairs in the way that's best suitable for them.
So you've touched on high level, what is GAR? So essentially it's the four main pillars, and how the courts have looked at GAR in the past. For our viewers, can you explain where in the Tax Act they can actually find the GAR, the General Anti-Avoidance Rules, as well as why is it so important for SARS?
Well, let's start with the first one. Why is it so important for SARS? What the GAR tries to achieve is that any legislature knows that they can't draft a legislative provision that tackles every single transaction that tries to avoid tax. So what they do is they create specific provisions. In a previous episode, we spoke about paragraph 43 cap A, spoke about section 8E, there's some other provisions, section 8C, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. They create specific anti-avoidance provisions. But then they give SARS, the executive, the power to also invoke general anti-avoidance provisions. And the idea behind that is to say that either where a step in a transaction or the transaction as a whole has with its primary aim an anti-avoidance element, tax element to it, and which takes place in a manner that's abnormal, those are transactions that we'd like to invoke the tax consequences of. And so what SARS can do in that scenario is they can then go and invoke the tax consequences to a specific transaction that they think should have applied in that specific case, or where the anti-avoidance takes place. Importantly, it tackles both the arrangement as a whole and each step.
Okay.
So you've always got to go and you can't just say, you know, it very often happens that most arrangements, if you view each step individually, they actually pass muster of the tax laws.
Yeah.
But it's very oftentimes the arrangement as a whole that's got a color or a taste to it that gets caught up by the GAR.
In terms of the four rules, the four pillars that's part of GAR, is it a question from SARS's perspective that you have to fall foul on all of them, or is it a each of them question? So if I fall foul just on abnormality, am I in a place where GAR will tackle the entire transaction, or must it first be an arrangement that's for tax avoidance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Or is it an is or and almost question at the end of the day?
No, it's an and. So okay. All of the requirements need to be met before you can tackle the specific GAR. Now, there's some, not for the purpose of this podcast or this discussion, there's some questions about in which part who bears the onus and what how the various tests apply. But the matter of fact is, the short answer to your question is, you need to have an arrangement that's primarily tax-driven. Sole main purpose must be tax-driven, that has a tax benefit, and then that is abnormal. Okay. And it's only once all three of those are. In practice, however, you'll see that if you rely on abnormality to get you out of the GAR, then you're probably busy with a very risky transaction.
Yeah, then you're already in GAR.
Then you're already in GAR, but then in the law, certainly, you know, you've got the ability to say, well, my transaction's not abnormal.
Yeah.
I'll give you a good example of something that might sort of hit the first three, but then on abnormality might not be so abnormal.
Yeah.
You have person X who sits on a bunch of listed South African securities. These listed South African securities pay annual dividends, and on those dividends tax, the individual pays 20% dividends tax every time. So every time these companies pay a dividend to the individual, there's a 20% tax cost to it.
Yeah. Let's call it R1 million a year.
It can be. You know, there's some portfolios that are substantial and the dividends on them are substantial. An advisor speaks to, or this client speaks to a clever advisor, it says, what you should do is you should have all your equities in a South African company. The reason being, you're reinvesting all these dividends, and in a South African company, you won't bleed the 20% dividends tax. So what you should do is you should do a Section 42 transaction, an asset for share transaction that allows you to tax neutrally roll over the value in those shares to a company so that you can save the dividends tax.
Exactly.
In that scenario, if we analyze it, there's certainly an arrangement. There is certainly a tax benefit. And the sole main purpose of it, you know, based on these facts, of course, there are other commercial reasons why they might do it. And if that's the taxpayer's reason for doing it, that's a different example. That's a different scenario and a different example altogether.
Yeah.
But certainly in this example, it's tax driven. The question becomes is it abnormal? But already when you get to that point, it's something that you should be wary of, right? And that you should know that there is an element of risk to it.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think such an arrangement is so abnormal, but I am cognizant of the fact that there's certainly some risk to doing that.
In terms of your experience, what are key red flags that you've seen that our viewers can sort of keep at the back of their minds as things to look out for that GAR might be applicable? Some practical things that you've seen.
I think we're typically where the GAR becomes very applicable, you know, or red flags. In some of the previous episodes, I said, look, if you see exempt dividends, that's a red flag.
Yeah.
I almost want to say in the GAR context, when you see complex transactions, things that involve 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, 15 steps, you've usually got to think about the GAR.
Yeah.
You know, sort of standard run-of-the-mill transactions with one or two steps, they typically are less likely to get caught up by the guard. It's very difficult to give a key indicator to say, you know, when your transaction contains this element. The guard is so wide and has such a wide ambit that it's too difficult to narrow it down to that point. But what I would say is the moment that you start getting convoluted transactions, if those transactions aren't certainly commercially driven, you know, to achieve a certain commercial outcome, then you should certainly start thinking about the GAR.
Okay, fantastic. And what would you say are effective defense strategies against the GAR?
I think what happens oftentimes is that people do have very good facts. They've got very good merits that can defend them against the GAR. But what I've found is that people are very good at articulating them to you in a meeting or in a conversation, but they're very poor at documenting them in a way that creates a legal paper trail.
Yeah.
And so that would always be my sort of my advice is you can't take words or sentiments to a court.
Yeah.
What you can take to a court is legal documents.
Yeah.
And documenting your process, documenting why you do it, directors' resolutions that show and that articulate the reasons the directors are entering into this restructure is to achieve the following commercial outcomes.
Yeah.
You know, correspondence between directors, sort of further advocating what had been said in a directors' meeting.
Yeah.
Those are important and key, instrumental at least, documentary evidence that you require to ensure that the GAR doesn't, that you don't fall foul of the GAR.
Okay, fantastic. When we move over, right? So we've got this general anti-avoidance section in the Income Tax Act. And like you said, a lot of times you get it right. All your steps are, each of them can be justified, that it's not, that GAR can't attack each of the steps. And to a certain extent, your entire transaction is, let's call it, signed off from a GAR perspective. But you know it's not necessarily the true intent. So my understanding is that's when the simulation doctrine comes in. So can you explain the simulation doctrine to the everyday person, the non-tax, non-legal business operator? How would you explain that topic to them?
I think there's a fair amount of case law on the simulation doctrine. And so you could go very technical and explain some of the things that have been said. And I'm sure we'll get into one or two of those nuggets in a moment. But the way that I would explain it to the everyday man on the street is, if your transaction is a wolf dressed in sheep's clothing, so you are pretending it to be something, but we all know that tacitly there is an underlying agreement for it to be something else.
Yeah.
Take, for example, I'm not saying that all cases like these are, but there are definitely cases like of this nature that could fall within a simulated one. I give a loan to you. I have no intention of you to repay that loan. I don't charge any interest on that loan. I basically give you the loan and we're both going to walk away and forget about it. Now, there's a good chance that that transaction could actually be seen as a donation.
Yeah.
Yes, I document it as a loan. Yes, I say that it's a loan at the top of the agreement, right at the top, loan agreement between Bobby and Kwesi. But if you look at the essentiality of it, the essence, it's not a loan. It doesn't contain any of the characteristics that one would see in a loan, and it actually appears more to be akin to a donation.
Yeah.
And those are type of scenarios in which the simulation doctrine could apply, you know, where SARS can say, but we're going to give effect to the substance over the form of the agreement. We're going to give effect to this other tacit agreement that you have. Sometimes it's as easy as, it's relatively simple, let's put it that way, as just a loan, this loan scenario.
Yeah.
Other times it gets a little bit more tricky. And there are tacit agreements underlying the main agreement that actually undermine the main agreement and its substance. And both those scenarios, I think, are ones where the simulation doctrine becomes particularly sort of relevant.
So my understanding also is that the simulation doctrine, it's not written law, if I can say it like that. It's not, you're not going to find it in the Tax Act or in some other book necessarily. It's common law. Can you explain the difference between written law, if I can say it like the Tax Act, and then the common law and how the simulation doctrine then falls into that?
So certainly the difference between statutory law and sort of common law is, in statutory law, it's captured in words in a piece of legislation, the GAR, for example. The GAR is captured in the Income Tax Act, and these requirements that we spoke of, it lists. Common law isn't captured, and as you've sort of rightly pointed out already, it's not captured in any specific legislation. It's built up over time using the common law, you know, for us as South Africans, but also through case law,
yeah.
you know, that build up. So in South Africa, we've got a few cases, Invercar, Randall Brothers, Sasol Oil, all dealing with matters of simulation and all developing in some form of way the simulation doctrine. Yes, of course, we've got case law that develops some of elements of the statutory law. You know, in the case of the GAR, there's case law that says, okay, what does solo main purpose mean? Or, you know, how should we look at solo main purpose? What is a tax benefit actually for purposes of the GAR? Yes, we certainly have that. There's some developments there where common law assists in developing our meaning of the statutory law. But in this case with simulation, there's just simply not a rule that you can go to in the Income Tax Act.
Yeah.
You just base yourself on the common law rules. And some of those common law rules that apply in simulation is, you know, one of the statements that come from these cases that I've mentioned is that a simulated transaction is typically a disingenuous transaction,
yeah.
a dishonest transaction, one that the parties don't genuinely intend to enter into. They intend to enter into something else. And importantly, commercial justification for a transaction doesn't mean that it's not simulated. So very oftentimes people say, yeah, but there's very good reasons why we would do that. That's not the test for simulation. The test is what you are intending to do or what you're intending to say in these agreements, yeah. is that what you actually intend to do?
Yeah.
Or is there a tacit understanding elsewhere that you're going to do something else?
So what are steps that we as advisors in these M&A transactions, in restructurings, et cetera, what are some steps that we can take to make sure we don't fall foul of the simulation doctrine, especially ensuring we have a commercially well-documented transaction at the end of the day?
Simulation is a difficult one because it relies quite a lot on the intention of the taxpayers or the intention of the parties. So I think what's most important is that the documents actually reflect the fair intention of the parties.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike the GAR that, you know, has got some technicalities and poor documentation might trip up some of those technicalities, simulation requires, to me, a further bird's eye view sort of connection with the transaction to say, listen, what do the parties really intend to do here? Is it a donation or is it a loan?
Yeah.
You know, and to make sure that the essence of those transactions are properly captured in your agreements, which I think, you know, tax aside, simulation aside, that's what a good advisor would do and that's what you would aim to do. But it's to refrain from transactions where we are saying one thing in agreement, but we all know that in the drawer somewhere elsewhere, there's a different understanding of what we're going to do and what we're going to take place. And one should steer clear of those scenarios because they are the ones that can basically mean that you fall foul of the simulation doctrine.
I think that's a very important point, is making sure you have the right people giving you advice at the end of the day. Although we're not saying certain advisors are better than other advisors, all we're saying is certain people have different perspectives at the end of the day. And you need to make sure that wherever you are doing transactions, you have the right people around the table. Specifically, like, we work together quite a lot on transactions. I know I've got a few blind spots that you cover me on, and I've got certain financial points where we give you guys then some things to look at, things to consider at the end of the day. And just like Maynard always says, we actually laugh sometimes in the office when he mentions that everyone knows when Maynard starts speaking, he's going to say high level. But this is so important, especially for simulation, because high level, if you look at the transaction, what is it? Are you true or are you not? And you need to be able to make sure that as a good advisor, you are telling people the truth. You are telling, listen, this is either it's not or it is a simulated transaction at the end of the day.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that sums up the gist of simulation very, very well.
Absolutely. If we round it off at the end and you could give a few key takeaways for our viewers today on both on GAR and simulation, what are things for them just to consider, to think about when they go into transactions? Most of our viewers are either very technical advisors or completely run-of-the-mill ordinary business people that's in the process of a restructure or an M&A transaction. So what would you give as a good nugget for both of them almost to be able to take home?
I'd say leave a proper paper trail of your commercial outcomes. Make sure that you document very clearly and sufficiently across the board what your commercial outcomes are that you want to achieve to ensure that, you know, it's prevalent in, yeah, your commercial transactions, and make sure you do it honestly. Don't have side agreements. I'm not, yeah, a fan of side agreements.
No.
They don't work. And somewhere along the line, someone is going to get hurt by them.
Absolutely. Bobby, thank you so much. Thank you for your time. We appreciate it. And that's a wrap. That is a wrap on our episode on GAR, General and the Avoidance Rules, and the Simulation Doctrine. Bobby, thank you for joining us today. Thank you for your insight, your expertise. And we are excited for our next episode coming up in a while. We're also going to discuss with Bobby specifically on what is a quality advisor at the end of the day and the importance of tax opinions. Thank you very much.